Welcome to today's episode. We're in for a treat today because I got to talk to someone who I've admired for a long time, Dr. Gloria Rosario Wallace. We talked about racializing the Latinx experience, responding when someone tells you that your Spanish is wrong, and owning your story and relationship to your heritage language. Gloria is a Black Dominicana educator, scholar, activist who is committed to supporting racially conscious, human-centered school and organizational leadership. In her professional and personal worlds, she aspires to center and hold space for Black women and femmes and celebrate Black joy in its many forms. As a former global history teacher, lead teacher, staff developer, assistant principal, and principal, her focus remained on developing loving, safe, affirming, intellectually curious, and culturally reflective communities for our children. She spent 13 years working in transfer high schools, where she co-founded a high school in Brooklyn, New York for overage, undercredited students, an opportunity that allowed her to use her liberatory and critical pedagogy to design an inclusive learning community. Gloria is a proud graduate of the Vanderbilt Peabody College of Education and Human Development, the Bank Street College of Education, and the Urban School Leadership Division within the Graduate School of Education at Fordham University. She currently works for the New York City Department of Education in the Bronx, New York. She is also the founder of Grow Together LLC, which offers support through consultation, coaching, and system design for racial equity within communities and teams. Gloria is also a dear friend of mine and just a wonderful human being in general. She shared so much wisdom for educators, leaders, and parents alike. I am pleased to welcome to the show Dr. Gloria Rosario Wallace.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for the warm welcome. And I feel like I definitely need a shorter bio.
No, this bio is definitely appropriate for everything that you've accomplished and all of the wealth of knowledge and experience that you're bringing here. And one of the things that you didn't mention was the Leadership Academy and being a graduate of that. That's actually where we first crossed paths at the Leadership Academy. And really centering your work around the liberation and the education of Black and brown boys and children in the schooling system. And so I was really happy that we could cross paths there. However many years later, here we are again, continuing the conversation about liberatory education through the lens of multilingual spaces. Before we get into kind of the education part of it, I wanted to start with your personal story. And there are so many places to start, but let's start with how it all began. What was your experience with language loss or preservation growing up? And how did that impact your decision to raise multilingual children and support multilingual students?
As I listen to the question, I like immediately picture my mother's house, the house I grew up in. My mom and my dad came here separately from the Dominican Republic, and each were born and raised there. Spanish was their primary language for my father, at least conversationally. He also spoke French and Creole. And for my mom, Spanish is definitely her primary language. Also, my parents' first language is not English, right? Their dominant language is not English, but also they made a choice of like, we don't want to raise a monolingual family. So my father is really committed to becoming like as proficient in English as possible because he was a talker. He liked to get to know people. He wanted to know what was going on. So I think for him, it was really important to be able to like, walk up to whoever he wanted to and like say, what, you know, what's going on, what's happening. For my mom, for a long time, I didn't think she spoke much English at all. And then in different scenarios, like the mask would be revealed. I was like, wait a second. And I realized it was just like her choice. She doesn't like it. She didn't want to become more proficient in it than she has to be. So growing up, it was like a Spanish-only environment, at least for me. My older brothers were bilingual, so they often spoke to each other in English, and they're outside the house life felt like it was all in English. And for my parents, we only spoke in Spanish. And then when I went to school and I started kindergarten was when I formally started learning English beyond like Plaza Sésamo, which is really all I remember my mom like saying, you know, you should learn English and like, let's watch the show. Yeah. But in kindergarten, I started receiving, I remember being ESL, which is like the old school term, and I had pull-out services. That was my experience. So that's what, how I formally started learning English, was through the pull-out method, where somebody would come. I don't remember ever being in the same time. I'm sure there was a schedule. I would be taken out of class, go into this tiny room with a teacher, and we would just like practice different like English words and like activities. So obviously, like as time went on, I became dominant in English just by like exposure. And I think I also received a lot of pressure from my family to be a good student. So then that meant I had to like figure this out. But even like, as long as I lived in my mom's house, it was a Spanish only house. I was having a conversation with one of my siblings, she would like interrupt it and say like, in this house, we only speak Spanish. And then, you know, I grew up and life goes on. So in my like, quote, my real life, as an adult, going to school, going to college, choosing to become a teacher, choosing to become a principal, I didn't really speak much Spanish in my life. Like, as a teacher, I often would get students who only spoke Spanish because the principal would know I was bilingual and I could, like, help. But there was never any, like, professional development or any further certifications, right? Like, it was always, like, almost like a backdoor thing. So I never felt pressure to like improve my Spanish because my conversational Spanish, my Dominican slang Spanish was good enough. Like it got me through. And it wasn't until I became a principal where I was like, okay, I need to like look up some words here. I need to like have a bigger vocabulary because I would translate most meetings. I always felt like it was important for the families to know that like you can talk to me in either of these two languages, and we will make it work. It was then that it really became clear to me, like, what it meant to other people that I could, at least, I was engaging and trying, like, particularly parents. It's funny, I wasn't actually in the Leadership Academy. The founding principal was, and I remember through the Leadership Academy, I was invited to all these opportunities, and that's where I met my coach, Sonia, and it was like through all these opportunities that present themselves to me, it was a way of like deepening who I am and what I know, right? So like I started like my language journey without a choice, right? I was raised in this house and this is what we do here. And it never felt strange or odd as a child that we only spoke Spanish because I think the majority, if not every friend I had in school had the same story. And it wasn't until I went to high school and college where then I felt like there was a tension about what part of the world do you come from and how do these words fall out of your mouth and is it like proper and what does proper mean, you know, all those kinds of like coded language. So and then as an adult and as a principal and like being in charge of this tiny little organization, but seeing parents that looked like mine, like tired immigrant parents who were like, I can show up to the school for 20 minutes and then I need to eat or I need to rest or I need to take a nap before my next shift. Like I recognize those families as my own, but for them to say like, how do you speak so well? And no one ever said that to me, right? Like before fighting with the teachers about my word choice, right? Like, you know, where do you put the car in el parqueo? Parqueo is not a word. I remember going
to the army. But it is, because I use it, right? Yeah. It's not in my book.
Exactly. Well, that's what they meant. It's not in my book. This is not in the textbooks. It's not a word. And I remember one summer in high school going to the ER of my family, and I saw, like, written on a wall, parqueo, huge words, like, letters. And I took a picture of it. And this is before a camera phone, so I had to, like, go to the pharmacy and develop the picture. And I brought it to school to show, like, you know, Senora O'Brien or whoever. I was like, you see, this is how we did, right? And, like, always feeling I had to fight for, like, validation or getting marks off on my papers, my tests, and fighting. Like, and I'm not a grade fighter. I was never the sort of person who was like, this is not a B+, it's an A. That's not really my DNA. But in Spanish class, it was totally my DNA because it felt like judgment on my mom and my community of right. like, we're making stuff up here. So then fast forward years later to have parents and adults that I'm working with and I really respect and I really want them to be happy and I really want them to approve of the school community that they've chosen, put their children in, for them to say, how do you speak Spanish so well? I felt like almost crazy. Like, what is this? Like, out of this world, this is strange. I've never heard this. And they were often asking, like, what did your parents do? Because my child won't speak Spanish to me. And I was like, so that's when I knew I was in something deeper, that I needed to do some more talking to other people and more reading and more thinking, because it was is bigger than like, this kid just doesn't want to speak to me. There's more to it. They obviously, like for the most part, most of the students I worked with really loved and adored their parents. They were like just petrified, or they were taunted and humiliated because of the Spanish they spoke by other kids who were native English speakers, right? And I didn't have that experience. So I think because I didn't have that, I never had that extra baggage that comes to talking. So when I became a parent, it was like not a deep question. It wasn't like a hard one. The decision to raise our children bilingual. The hard part is I married someone who is not a native Spanish speaker. So then like, how do we do this in an equitable way where I'm not like a mother and a part-time like Spanish language au pair over here, like doing lessons on the rug, because that also felt like draining, and like parenting is enough, right? So how do I keep language alive and keep my kids engaged and wanting to talk and play and sing, and it doesn't feel like a chore or like homework or like a disappointment? So that's kind of been, that's like the conversation that we're always in, as a like in partnership of like, how are we doing this together? And how are we doing this in a way that feels like age appropriate and like a lifetime thing? Like you never, I don't feel like you ever perfect a language. Like I'm still figuring English out, right? There's still words and turns of phrases, and language is always evolving. So I'm always learning things I didn't know, and language changes. So then like, how do I stay engaged and connected to that?
Yeah. Wow. There's so much to unpack there, so much kind of golden nuggets to dig into. One of them was around your understanding that your language wasn't wrong, even though a person in a position of authority was telling you that it was, which happens to our students so much, whether it's the Spanish that they speak or it's the English that they speak, right? African-American vernacular English. Any other kind of way of speaking beyond like the standard what's taught in a textbook is often said by teachers that it's wrong rather than it's different. It's a different way. That's another way to say garage in Spanish. And I have another way in my book. And I think that can really be internalized. And I know at least for my, like my parents who were only, you know, raised speaking Spanish, similar story to you, went to school, was the first time that they were in an English environment. And at that time in Texas, they were like punished physically and emotionally for speaking Spanish. And then when they finally took a Spanish class, they were told that their Spanish was wrong. Right. And so there is an internalization that like, okay, I don't really speak Spanish that well, and I'm not going to use it then. And having like a self-consciousness about it, which I can also kind of see with my mom still, now that I'm asking her to like speak to our children just in Spanish, that she can feel self-conscious around like not knowing enough or not sure if it's the right word or if we have different words that we're using, than thinking like, oh, I don't know, like this probably isn't right. When I'm like, no, it's just a different way of saying it, which I think, you know, a part of why we started the Language Preservation Project is because language learning often is not like recognizing all of this baggage and context and like institutional kind of stripping of our assets and the effect that that has had on our community and what it takes to like preserve a language isn't just about learning the language. It's about all of the other stuff that comes with it. And I think it's really great to hear how you like resisted that in your school setting. And you were not necessarily, I don't think, like, you know, picking or fighting about a grade, but it was about like this being a legitimate way of speaking, and we should have that conversation. And yeah. I wonder if there's like a place where you kind of got that from.
The thing that comes up for me in thinking about this is like we have to racialize it. So both my parents are fighters, but like in different ways, right? And my father passed when I was 15. So I've only, you know, so I remember things, and I've seen my mother now, like throughout like decades, like how her attitude how she's applied her lens to different things, right? In different like contemporary issues I don't have with my father, but I remember them clearly often fighting about things, whether my mother was much more like local to go global, or my father is like all up in the mix. Like if he would have been alive for social media, he would have loved it, because he was always like, "In this is what's happening here. And I read this book by this author." And the thing of it was, when they came to this country in the early 80s, there was a huge influx of Dominican immigrants. And like, you know, in like recent history, not the sort of immigrants the United States like wants, right? Or wanted. Yeah. Whoever is in the White House, doesn't matter. It's pretty clear by immigrant policy, like who are the immigrants we want in this country, and how easy is it to become a citizen or not, right? And how much money you have to pay to become a citizen or not. When they got here, it was just like this, the wave and the backlash was already starting. There's too many of these poor brown people from this island. Like, how many more are coming? Get that, like, what is this? Let's just corral them in a place. So I remember it was always very intense in like primary and middle school, because when you would read about, like, we would read about World War II, we would read about, you know, the intentional housing and segregation of communities to track them. Kids would say like, "Oh, like Washington Heights? Is that why we all live together?" But it was very clear for me of like, something's going on here, right? Because if I take the train 5 stops, I'm in like a much cleaner, like the air smells different, right? Like in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Like what's up with that, right? So for me, when people would try to make my language or my culture or my parents less than, it hit a really strong, and it still hits a really particular nerve, because my parents were constantly telling me, like, we are as good as other people. It doesn't matter how we got here. We're as good as other people. So I feel because I had an experience where there was a lot of positive affirmation of who I was and my family was culturally and ethnically, I got a really strong dosage, like overdosage of like, we are Black, we are proud, we speak Spanish, our Spanish is good. Having that foundation then shapes how I interact with the world, versus if your parents have been so traumatized. And I often feel like it's like the children of the people who got here who get the brunt of it, because we're the ones who have to interface with white people more, right? Like when I think about my parents, they were in the Dominican immigrant world, right? And so then when I would then interface with the world, and all my teachers until middle school were white women, who I think they all lived in New Jersey. So you have these people who plop into our lives just from 9 to 5, or you know, whatever the school hours are, and then they leave. They don't really know our community. They don't know us. And that's where there was a lot of comments about whether it's my physical appearance, my hair, my nose, my skin, or like how I spoke Spanish. But I think being in a really saturated place like Washington Heights, by the time I got to middle school, the 2 or 3 teachers now that were Black and brown teachers, that I had one teacher in PS28, Mrs. Fields, shout out to her. She was doing God's work. She was like trying to give all the love she could to every little child in that school. Because she was it. I don't remember any other teacher of color besides like a substitute teacher. And she was Puerto Rican, but she had been here in New York for generations, right? So she was really acculturated. And I remember getting a lot of like feedback from her that I rejected, right? Around like how I spoke and how I behaved. And then in middle school, I had finally some Dominican American teachers. So even then, like they would say, "Oh, the way you speak, that's okay at home. But when you go to school, if you go for an interview, you gotta like You know, there's an ER at the word or at the end of the word. You got to say it. And my family also definitely policed the way I spoke because they worked really hard to get rid of their country accents, right? So my mother's family is from the center of the country in the Cibao, which is like an agricultural region. She's from Santiago de los Caballeros. And like there's a very pronounced particular regional accent that they all, like no one has it. And then being in this country, and I always was like, who am I supposed to speak like? So I understood at home, okay, you want me to talk like my mom? You want me to talk like my siblings? Sure. Which is like, which Dominican accent is acceptable for the world? That was like the game at home. And then in school, there was all this talk about Spain. And mm-hmm. I was like, what does Spain got to do with me? Like, I really didn't get it. Like, they speak Spanish too. Who cares? Right? That was kind of. Yes. My primary school, middle school attitude. And I remember there was a story of Primer Impacto of all these Dominican women that immigrated to Spain under false pretenses. They were told that they were getting a visa for work, for like domestic work, and they ended up in brothels and the sex trade. So I hear like a Dominican accent. So I'm looking at the TV, see people that look like us. And I was like, wait, what's happening? Like, I don't even think I understood what sexual slavery was, but I knew it was bad. And nobody wanted to be associated with that. And then I was like, wait, where are they? And my sister was like, oh, they're in Spain. And I was like, okay, that's all I need to know. So for like the next 10 years of my life, I was like, Spain is not a good place.
No.
I don't want to go there because of Primer Impacto. Like they told me everything I need to know. So when I got to high school and the construct was, we need to learn vosotros and we need to have this accent. And we watch these videos and listen to these like cassette tapes of these skits or whatever, and it was all with this Spanish accent, I was really like offended. And obviously there was no cultural exposure to anything Spanish besides that Primer Impacto story. Like, and I was just like, why isn't there anything about like Cuban people? Why isn't there anything about Puerto Rican people? I was like, give me anything. Panamanian, like give me something. That was not the construct of the pedagogy and the content. Didn't allow for that. Like the teachers didn't even know what I was talking about and why that would be important. Because why would you want to learn Spanish from a place that was subpar, right? The standard is Spain. So once I figured that out, it like just changed the way I interacted and how much I cared how I did, you know, academically.
That's so powerful. I think being able to see how that reaction impacted your engagement, but also to be able to have some type of resistance to that. And I think you really kind of set the foundation and credit your parents for being able to understand that, to be able to racialize it from a young age and understand like the dynamics of that. I definitely did not have that growing up. I think I maybe more like internalized that like, oh yeah, this is bad, or like the accent in English even that I have is bad, or the slang Spanish that I have is bad. And it wasn't until I got to college to start to like understand more of these systemic historical like dynamics that I was able to understand that isn't right. Like I should not feel ashamed of where I came from. I should not feel ashamed of like being who I am and where I come from. And I think it really matters like teachers, curriculum, books, materials. From your perspective of being an educator and being a parent, how do you navigate some of those challenges of affirming the identity of your children as like beautiful Black mixed culture children and raising them in Spanish as well?
My mother, and I think this is the lesson that I take from my parents to my own parenting, is that they were just like, I don't know, like hawks. And if someone said something negative about us, like, nope. Like, so they never were, even when we were wrong, like, like dead wrong. My mom's like, nope. So, you know, it can go both ways. You gotta not lean into it too much. But she would really defend our right to like show up however we were showing up. But she never corrected my Spanish, which I think is kind. But at some point, you do have to kind of jump in there and be like, let me just explain this like this principle, right, of grammar. But I think my mom never felt comfortable with anything academic. She never felt comfortable in school. She didn't feel comfortable as a student. So she never corrects. Sometimes she will say like a factual error, but something really nitty gritty of like, you know, whatever tense, I would never hear her say something. My sisters would jump in and be like, oh, here's the actual rule. So if they weren't around, so I definitely have said things that were just like all sorts of crazy have felt like that hot shame of like embarrassment of like, oh my God, I really said like some crazy thing right now. I'm so sorry. But I guess the thing that has sustained me in that moment is rarely have people, like peers laugh at like peers. Like, I think that's just kind of like the deal. But whenever I've been trying to speak Spanish, like to help, whether I'm in line somewhere and like someone's trying to figure out, I'm like, you want me to step in real quick? You need some help? Like, no one's like laughed at me when I'm trying to help translate or like if I'm in a parent teacher conference. Like, I've just always been so impressed with how much patience and kindness other people have. No, I cannot write an essay. I can't write a blog. I don't think. Maybe I could have a conversation, but I don't think I would have a recorded conversation. I guess that's why it's so important for me that my kids don't feel like this is do or die. You messed up if you don't know it. You're saying the wrong word. How embarrassing. Like, I don't want any of that. Like, the way I look at language is like, I can pick it up. I can put it down. I can, like, it's mine. I don't have to like frame it. I don't have to announce it. I have it. I own it. So however I want to like jump in and out of it, which is how I feel like very wealthy people feel about their stuff, right? You might have like a very fancy Rolex. Maybe I'll wear it on a Tuesday. Maybe I'm not, right? But if that's all I have, I may cling to this really shiny thing. So I actively try not to feel like this is my one shiny thing. So I remember as an adult, there was a point when I stopped trying to be monolingual all the time, because there are phrases or ideas or like that come up in like English conversation. Everybody here speaks English, but I think the way I'm going to process it, I'm going to do a little bit a mix right now to get my thoughts out together. Or sometimes something's so funny, I got to say something in Spanish, or something's so crazy, I got to say something in Spanish. And I remember always getting the message that that wasn't okay. Like, I don't know who told me that or why I have that in my head, but I have rejected it. So, and it's funny because like my English speaking, like monolingual, like friends and colleagues, they'll check me if they're like, wait, you know, you haven't said, you know, buenos dias, mujeres, like when you walked in, right? Because I remember when I started really trying to be good about gender, it kind of removed a lot of my Spanish, because I still was like, how do I say this in a way where it's not totally gendered, right? And one of my colleagues was like, you know, when you call me mujer, it's the nicest part of my day. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, I didn't realize I just like totally stripped these things out of my vocabulary. So for me, it's like giving myself permission to like say whatever I need to. Also, this is the hardest part, I think, for me, is like, not just to speak to my children in Spanish, like when I'm really annoyed about something, because like that is very easy, right?
Yeah.
And also, this is not like fake, right? I'm not going to like talk to you in my teacher voice. Like, you're my children. We live here. We're here all the time. So how is this like a normal, natural thing? So the thing about at least our parenting style, which might not hit all the experts' books, is that it's very repetitive. So like, you know, when Coco came out, we watched Coco maybe every week until the kids like kind of outgrew that. Even if it's like an English language film, where are the bilingual moments? And you know, when our kids are, you know, 2 and 6, so like that's right in their wheelhouse. They can watch something 800 times. It doesn't bother them. Obviously, that'll be a strategy we have to like change up as they get older. But like, who are the people who are having these conversations like in an age appropriate way? And I think finding community with other parents and other like folks who are really into early childhood books. And it's not just about Spanish and Dominican culture and Jamaican culture. But it's also like, this is a common conversation with all my friends of like, wherever they're from, they just want their kids to feel some pride about that. Right. But then also like, where am I modeling that? So what am I listening to? Who am I talking to? Like, it's all wrapped up. And I think sometimes in this conversation about raising children to be bilingual, it's like, so we're looking at children like widgets. Like, we want them to, like, you know, load up, get to 100% and like move on. And like, that's not how people learn. That's not how, at least that's not how I want to live. So then how do I do this in a way that's for real? Like, so if speaking, being able to speak both in English and Spanish is important to me and important enough that I want them to do it, then how am I doing it in my life? Then they need to see that too.
I love that. And such a good like question to reflect on continuously. Like, if I want my child to be this way, insert bilingual, mm-hmm. insert kind, insert reflective, how am I doing that myself? And I think that that's really critical in parenting to be able to reflect upon it. And especially bilingualism, because it's not something that we often think about of like, what's my relationship to this language and how am I modeling that for my child? And I'm still like processing what you said around just like it not being your whole identity, right? It's like one part of your identity and not holding on to it so tight and showing up as you are and knowing that like, however fluent you are, however it comes out, whatever your relationship to the language is good enough and is valid. And I think that that message is really important to pass on to our children so they don't feel this like intense pressure. And that intense pressure could affect their relationship to the language, which ultimately, I mean, for me, for my children, like I want them to have a positive relationship to the language because I know that like if they have a positive relationship to the language, they will be more inclined to learn it, to access it, to be able to know that part of their culture, their family, and where they came from. And so that's also been, I think, a real mindset shift for me is to like, know that you can't control the outcome. You can just control the input and the process and having to be really thoughtful about that. I think in parenting in general is that like anything, you can't control what your kids are going to decide to do or how they're going to react to what you're, the environment that you're creating.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. And I agree with that, like a framework with all, what are all the important things that we want to like gift our children. And I feel like the pressure to do it well is the thing that will ruin it because we're like gripping onto it. And not caring about like our children's experience with it. So ultimately, I think the reason it was so easy for us to say, yes, we want to stress bilingualism at home. We want to expose both of our kids to the language and practice. And like, we want to do this is so they can talk to my mom, really. Like, that's like, that was like the first goal. And I feel like I have a lot of friends and acquaintances who have like tense relationships with their families. But it was because like they could never really talk to them. And when they would try to talk to them, it wasn't successful, right? As opposed to that one elder who was like, I don't really know what you're saying, but I'm still gonna show you love. Like you can show love and gratitude and like surround someone with that without speaking, right? That's possible. It's hard. And I think particularly for families like mine and parents like mine who lived through so much trauma and like difficulty, it can be hard for them or for my mother now to like show physical love and let down her walls because of like the life she had to live. But like if she hadn't at least done that sometimes, then I think it's so much easier to be like, whatever, like I'm just gonna focus on me, I'm gonna focus on my career, focus on like whatever are those like illusions of things that make that you think will make you happy. I think for us, we fundamentally believe that like relationships and community is like what makes us happy. So that's what we want for our children.
I can resonate with that a lot because, I mean, obviously the name of this podcast is Talking to Grandma. And that's because like, I couldn't talk to my grandma most of my life. And you're right, you can still have a relationship with those people in your life that love you, but it is enhanced so much when you can have a meaningful conversation and you can understand each other in a meaningful way. I just thought about how much I lost for so long not having that, and also thought about how grateful I was for having learned the language and being able to unlock that, because some of my siblings can't, and most of the great grandchildren in our family like can't have those conversations with her. And she's now like in her 90s, which is not like that many years left to be able to build that relationship. Tell me a little bit about the dynamic in your house being the heritage Spanish speaker and cultivating bilingualism in your family. Like, what does that look like with your partner, and how do you ensure that it's a joint effort and not all on you?
I mean, yeah, I think that's definitely a tough one. So part of that is, well, one, as much exposure to my family as like possible, which pre-pandemic was much easier. So like for my daughter, she was able to spend a lot of time with my mom. I would, when she was, you know, preschool age, I would just drop her off once a week without me. And then we would go on weekends to spend time. And I think that really helped not just like make her comfortable, but like also like adventurous and want to like in that pre-verbal stage, just like try out sounds, because the sounds are different. And I think those are like fun. Sometimes it feels silly to say a word because of the sound your mouth has never formed before in English. So if you have practice with that, I think it helps with the nerves. And then there were conscious things where, you know, we put her in a Spanish immersion preschool. And that was like maybe a year, half a year. Unfortunately, the thing with language, right? So language is such a key part of culture, but there's so much more part. There's a lot to culture. I really like value being bilingual, and I really value being able to like talk within my family and my community. But there's a lot of things about Latinidad and Dominican culture that I don't want to seep into this house, right? So like, it was funny, the Spanish immersion preschool was great for her language development, and it was like exploding. She was like singing songs and having full conversations. But she was really rejecting the, it was very strict. There was not a lot of progressiveness and child-centered. And it just was a different like approach to raising little ones. They were loving and it was awesome. And I thought she had fun. But like even the dress code was really strict, and they had to wear certain colors and they couldn't wear other colors, you know. And we have like a little unicorn kid who just wants to wear rainbows all the time. Mm-hmm. So like eventually we had to move her out of the Spanish immersion preschool into like a more progressive preschool, which is like culturally not connected to anything, right? It was like a very white space. Yeah. And I was like, like, you know, like that tension, right? So that's when Kevin and I were like, okay, well, we really have to then pick this up if she's not getting this throughout the day. So it comes in books, right? And the good thing about at least the preschool age is like Kevin could be an equal partner, because like he can read, like he can handle that amount of language, yeah, right? And that vocabulary. It's like when things get more complicated. And we've talked about like we have to also improve our own language skills, like, and how do we do that? So that's kind of like an ongoing conversation. We followed the same suit with our son, but our son was born, I think, 6 months before lockdown. So like, yeah, he was 6 months old when we all came home. So we weren't really like a video call, Skype, Zoom people. We became that. So they both have weekly calls with both their grandmothers. And like, we are kind of those annoying parents that we're constantly talking to the teachers about like their bicultural children. And like, we want them, like they need exemplars. They need to like, everything can't be about, you know, a little white boy and his dog. Like that cannot be the story every day. It can be once a week, but every other day we need something else. The emphasis on language is the same as the emphasis on having grounding, affirming, Afrocentric experiences for both our kids. Like we feel like it's embedded in both. So I think because it's not just like language for language's sake, And it's not just language because we think we should or it would make somebody else happy. Like, it's just folded into everything else we do. And like, you know, and like the books that we can't find, you know, sometimes I'll find it being read aloud on YouTube, or it's like constantly just like finding other ways. But then it's like, how do we then kind of limit the stuff we don't want? Like a very strict view on gender. Like, you know, gender is a spectrum. We need them to both get that, understand that that's cool, and like whatever they want to do is whatever they want to do. From now, as much as I can cut off a feeling of shame or difference, or like I'm assuming you'll be disappointed in whatever choices I'm making, like how can I cut that off by talking about gender and sexuality and race and all of the things that make you like perfect and you, like now? But this notion of like Spanish being this other thing or less than, like that comes up. Let's talk about it like as plainly as possible. And also understand that Spanish is a colonized language. It's not our indigenous mm-hmm. language. I don't know what our indigenous language is. Once again, it comes back to, I want my kids to be able to speak to their grandparents. I want them to be able to like book a flight to DR whenever they feel like it, because they can't, right? They can go, they can navigate, they can question, they can ask. And I do hope like just feeling like free to do so will open them up to want to learn other things too. So I think it's like, that's the thing as a parent. It's like, what's the thing underneath this? Like, what is making this compelling? What is not? What is making this tricky? And like, what are the messages we're sending? And like knowing ultimately what's our North Star. Like, I don't want to create this illusion that like we want our kids to become these like I felt like as a kid, some of my teachers were like, they would call Spanish the mother tongue and Spain the mother country. And I was like, that's gross. Like, why are you saying that?
I think it's really important to name that this is a colonized language that we have, not because we shouldn't be accessing it or we shouldn't be using it, but to recognize the effects of colonism on the language too, right? The idea that like there is one right way to speak it, and that North Star is actually Spain, and trying to get as close to that variation of Spanish as possible is an effect of colonization, right? And I think that the different variations of the language, the different manifestations of the language, is the resistance, you know, of each region, each kind of like indigenous community, the evolution of it through the years, and should be seen as something that's legitimate and should be seen as something that's valued. And at least, I mean, from my perspective in Mexico, like there's a ton of influence on the Spanish language from indigenous languages. And so I think that being seen and reflected in books, in Spanish books about Spanish as, you know, valid of a language, because we don't learn English in the U.S. as like, you know, a sub or a lesser version than like the original King's English in the U.K., right? We've just accepted it as something that has evolved over time. So I think that that is something important to keep in mind. And also making the connection to gender that you shared of like wanting your kids to be able to have access to lots of different types of information and lots of different representation, and understanding that gender is a spectrum, and how, you know, we can talk about it in our society and how we can start to build those muscles and have different types of conversations. I love that I'm starting to see Spanish change, right? Like, there are people that feel enough ownership over the language to say, I'm not gonna wait for anybody to tell me that this is okay to change the language. I'm just going to start to change the language. And we can see that that has shifted, right? So my child, like, we use ella and niña and amiga, and we talk about what it means. And I'm really, you know, struggling because I can't find that much literature or books that reflect that. So I find myself making things and trying to reinforce that, because that reflection is so really important to see it as real, as legitimate, as kind of a part of just the way things should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think like, as we think about culture, like, what are the things that I'm taking? What are the things that I'm leaving? And like to feel empowered to do that.
Wow. Gloria, I'm leaving with so much, like, just personally reflecting on how I can take a more like liberated approach to language learning and to like parenting in a multilingual environment. And I really appreciate your perspective on that and how that kind of informed your bilingual journey growing up as an educator and now as a mother. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I want to end with this last question. What's bringing you joy these days in your multilingual parenting journey?
Well, one of the things that's been really cool is my son, he's still like forming his complete sentences, but he started like singing to himself. One of the movies on rotation is Turning Red, which, you know, is not like, that's not our culture, it's not our language, but like they love it. And like, so every once in a while, like I'll walk past his room after, like, and he's waking up from his nap and he's just like singing to himself. And that is like the coolest thing, right? Aww. And like, but it just makes me, it like reinforces like, what are the things that we do want to bring into this house, right? Like, and my daughter will often repeat, there's a little like monologue the main character says about like, I say what I want, I do what I want. Like, it's like bravado. She's like, does not do anything that she actually wants to do. She does everything her mom tells her, but she's like trying to like pretend to be this independent, autonomous person. And my daughter would be like in the mirror, like, I do what I want, I say what I want, I am my own person. I'm like, all right, yeah.
Yes.
Like, so it's just cool. So that's been a really sweet thing because it's totally random to me. And it happened like, you know, 7 a.m. I'm walking to his room to wake him up and I just hear him going, oh, 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 in his little bed, like just over and over. And it's really cute. That's been
so adorable. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Are there any additional last thoughts that you want to share with our listeners, or also sharing where people can find you and learn more about your work?
So I think the best place probably to find me would be on Twitter, because that's like, I actually do try to tweet things. And that's G Rosario Wallace, all one word, on Twitter. And then I feel like I'm going to have to put a disclaimer that I'm not anti-Spanish. I have nothing against like the people and its land and its culture and beauty. And I think it's hard. I find that it's hard sometimes for Latinx folks to be critical of Spain. Like it's like you're talking about your cousin or something. So you might have to put a disclaimer in the podcast description. I have no beef with Spanish people. But I do have a beef with colonization.
Yeah. We can separate those two things.
Yeah.
That is possible. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Vero. This was fun.
Thank you for listening. Talking to Grandma is owned by the Language Preservation Project and sponsored by Onward. Rebecca De Leon is our editor and producer. The artwork for Talking to Grandma was created by Nancy Guevara. And I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides. We love hearing from you. Email us at hello@thelanguageproject.co, slide into our DMs on Instagram at @talkingtograndma, and remember, please subscribe or follow us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you are listening right now. Help us grow our community and reach more families and educators by sharing this podcast or leaving a review. See you next episode.